Hamilton said in talking about that you can make an objective judgment about art, but how can it be that you can't prove that one thing is better than another?
Good question. Yeah. Here's where, when we say an objective judgment about art, we mean it. We're using, and I say we because other people said this too. We're using objective in a different sense than it's used in talking of science or ordinary sense evidence. We conclude that the experience of art tends towards objectivity. That's a safer way of putting it. Because, as I said just before, there seems to be a consensus of taste back over the ages about what's better art and what's inferior art. And we have to conclude that too, because experience shows us that if we would allow that anybody can like what he pleases in art, that the aesthetic verdicts were subjective, and you please yourself, well, things would have worked out until now with regard to art in an entirely different way than they had. I may think my daughter's drawings are just as good as Cézanne, and I'm entitled to my taste, and I might get some of my friends and relatives to agree with me, you know? And we're former clique in a faction to say that Sarah Greenberg's drawings are just as good as Cézanne's. And somebody said, well, you're out of your mind. And I said, well, what do you mean? Taste in art is subjective, you know? This is the way I see my daughter's drawings, you know? And you can't prove I'm wrong. See? The question of proof comes in. But we know from experience that somehow that anyone who thinks my daughter's drawings are that good, or good, we know from experience, though we can't prove it, that that person can't see painting. You know, and we can't prove it, and let's say we have public opinion on our side. Actually, we can go out in some places and find people who would say they preferred Sarah's stuff to Cézanne's. And they wouldn't count. Again, we'd say these people don't know painting. And so we work along with experience and we find out who does know painting. And we can't prove it at any given moment. We can. But somehow it turns out that certain people do know painting and others don't know it as well or don't know it at all. And almost always, hardly ever otherwise, the people who know painting turn out to be the people who look the most, that occupy themselves the most with painting, that work on their reactions to painting the most. It seems that follows so regularly that we can almost state it as a law. Allowing for the fact that there are a lot of people who do occupy themselves with paintings a good deal and so forth, who never acquire much taste. Though I always ask, about the particular circumstances of these people, I maintain they're either art historians always looking at slides, or or that the museum curators, who never take a good look, really, whose attention, or for some psychological reason or other, is unfocusable on pictorial art. Or something. You know, I've come across cases like that. And these people seem to be occupying themselves with art, and they're not. They're not looking. I've met art critics who come into my place, and there are a lot of pictures on the walls, and I won't say they're good pictures necessarily, but these guys will sit down and never take a look at them. They'll spend 2 or 3 hours talking to me and never once look at the pictures on the wall. Well, these people, you can say, spend a lot of time with painting and all that, but I think we have reason to believe they don't look at them. I think people who really look at painting often, long, seriously, end up by, as we say, knowing about painting, and also by agreeing by and large, not in unanimity, but in agreeing by and large with, as I said, a certain margin of error, a nimbus of error.
See, I think that it is possible to say that you can speak objectively about painting almost in a scientific way. This can be disagreed on, and it will be, I'm sure, but that what it has to do with is what makes up painting, and that it has to do with formal elements, and that what you can't talk objectively about it if it's not a painting, and that would be when you would say it was bad or something like that. Yeah. I know that sounds...
Well, think it out for yourself. You asserted that you think objectivity about art is almost scientific. Mm-hmm. Now you have to back that up. And I'm not asking you to do it right here. Because when you say almost scientific, you mean almost provable. And you have to give me examples of qualitative assertions about works of art that are almost provable. You have to give me examples then. So you don't say things unless you have evidence. You know, you don't maintain anything. And you know, you don't make generalizations unless you have evidence. You have to give me evidence. You may have the feeling, you know, oh, somehow it is provable that Shakespeare is better than advertising in general. It ought to be provable. This is what many English professors, they maintain it more than anybody else. It ought to be provable. If it's not, there's something wrong. You know, and then usually they don't bother about the question anymore, but they go wait there and well. This, whoever says that aesthetic judgments are not provable, he really doesn't know what he's talking about. Only I can't show him how he's wrong, but I know I will if I, you know, take the trouble about it. But these people never take the trouble about it. So what Kant said 200 years ago remains.
Sir, may I put it this way? I look around and I see people who are, let's say this is my monster girls. Some are sourpusses, some are beautiful, some are smiling, and so forth. Now it's subjective to me. What I appreciate is a, maybe this is the way I'm looking at it. I'm looking for it. Cheerful, objective, outgoing, and so forth. Beauty, this is what you were remarking on before, is purely subjective to me.
Well, the beauty of a human being it's not the same thing as artistic beauty. This is something that the philosophers of aesthetics have tried to cope with ever since aesthetics, before the discipline of aesthetics began in the 18th century. And Kant, I mentioned him once again, gentlemen, a beautiful girl to a man, they involves interest in beauty. Say, here you say, this girl may be my type. And you say, well, suppose I'm a girl and I say this girl is beautiful. Well, you get into further complications, but whatever it is, somehow it's agreed upon that this doesn't come within the realm of disinterested aesthetic experience. It can come, I think, within that realm. But I want to leave that aside. I think a beautiful girl, let me just say this. The beauty of a beautiful girl is low grade aesthetically. The beauty of a beautiful human being. I don't mean to discriminate against women. I'm sorry. The beauty of a human being is low grade aesthetically. But I'll try to explain that more in some later seminar.
All right.
No. Who hasn't asked? Tom?
I think we may have, by mistake, touched on something very important. Mm-hmm. And that's that there are certainly two kinds of beauty, and one would be natural beauty, naturally produced beauty. And the other would be human-produced beauty, which has to do with an editing process or a selection process.
Yeah, well.
And I think it's a commonly said remark here at Bennington College. Oh, that's beauty, that's nature, that's easy. Nobody had to make that. And it's very interesting that the beauty that's more challenging to us and more interesting is the beauty that's been selected.
Well, there's a good reason for that, but I don't want to go into it tonight, because that's a full night's work, I think. You haven't asked a question. Go ahead.
I was wondering about, you said earlier that all art is relations. I was wondering
almost. I should qualify.
What sort of relations did you mean?
Well,
and if it's sort of relations of elements within a work of art, how they relate to each other, how do you view the so-called non-relational art?
Well, let me say, when I said art boils down to a question of relations, I meant that within this qualification, art has to have some medium, that is sound or visibility or imaginability. That has to be that, and that's not just a question of pure relations, but let's say from that basis, you know those two passages of poetry I compared? I wanted to not show but imply that almost any given thing you could isolate in either passage of poetry depended for its effect on the relation to something else, and then in turn in relation to something else. And then you got groups of relations. Relations of sound, relations of rhythm, relations of medium, and then they're related in terms to meanings, in the case of poetry. And you go around, and nothing boils down quite to the heart of the poem, except nothing statable. All we can do is say poems tend to be rhythmic words in intelligible and maybe not in intelligible. They are intelligible. See, we get down to that, and that's a statement of relations. You know, once we're given words. And the same thing with music, the same thing with painting. You say paintings consistent colors put in a certain order on a flat surface. And about all you've said then is you've sketched out a whole system of relations. And you talk about a specific picture and you find yourself doing the same thing as you do with a passage, a poem. Where does the, you know, what is the heart of the picture? And we never find it. I don't expect you to understand what I mean right off, but try it sometime. Try to describe a work of art, the simplest work of art, satisfactorily. Just try it sometime. Say, well, as far as non-relational art, that's one of these can't, avant-garde-ish words. Someone makes a box, and he thinks because it's just a cube, he's eliminated all relations. Or say he lays down a flat sheet of steel, he lays down on the floor, and he says, there are no relations, there it is. That's the simplest element you can possibly choose with which to make a work of sculpture, a work of art. Well, actually, there are a lot of relations there. There's the relation of the thickness to the length. There's the relation of the length to the width. You've got three very important relations there. And you've also got the color of the sheet of steel. And you've got three or four sets of relations. Similarly, the box, there's height, width, length. And also, you bring volume in, I suppose. So when people say non-relational art, they're really being illiterate. See? And I'm a lot of the stuff you read in art magazines, and especially a lot of stuff said by artists themselves, who have no respect for language usually, does amount to intellectual illiteracy. I mean that in all seriousness. People who say utter complete absurdities, which shows they haven't thought in this particular area and they don't even understand what words mean in this particular area.
So you think all works of art are relational? In other words,
yes.
All the relations are intrinsic to all artistic experience.
Right. Intrinsic to all experience, I'd say.
It's impossible to see a whole without dividing it into parts and
That's
setting
right.
up relationships.
You take a ball, you've got the relation between the diameter, suppose it's an absolutely perfect circle. There's still the relation of its circumference to its diameter. You know, maybe this big a ball or maybe that big a ball. They're two different relations then. I'd say that doesn't convince you.
Well, I've seen, take a John's number thing, a big field one. The relations in that, there are relations that exist.
Oh, it's loaded with relations.
But the total effect of it, the artistic experience, I mean, the thing I experience when I see it, I don't think is, the relations are important to it.
You don't think
that the actual experience is not an experience of this particular relationship, but this whole system of relationships, which make a whole, and you see the whole.
Well, that's the way you can experience painting The Last Judgment by Tintoretto, too. You see it as a whole without seeing any of its parts or a bush. But you see them. But here we come again to the fact that we don't know what goes on in the mind when we're experiencing art. You can see a bush that's just wriggling all over with human figures and animals and monsters. And as a matter of fact, the first way to see it is to see it as a whole. If you hang up on a part of it, you're not seeing properly as a picture, in my opinion. But you may feel, well, I don't see any relations then. Because you're not looking at it intellectually anyhow. You're not looking at it part by part. That happens to be something almost peculiar to visual art. Now, the John's picture happens to be made up of relations, and they're responsible for the effect of the picture. You can't just discount them and say, because I don't feel it as a congeries of parts, therefore it has no parts. The parts are necessary to the whole. What are you going to do? Cut out a half a corner of the picture and say, well, since I feel it as a whole, you can take away parts.
You don't necessarily destroy any relationships.
Well, you're eliminating them. I mean, you're looking at the picture, you're seeing the whole rectangle. Everything counts if you're looking at it, whether you're aware of it or not. If you're looking at it as a picture. It doesn't matter what you wear of specifically. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think I know what direction you're heading
in. Well, the direction's enough. Pat?
You?
Physical analysis, not aesthetic analysis necessarily. I can't analyze the quality. See? Let's take one of Carl Andre's flat.
Insert quality, right?
You get it, you intuit it. You intuit quality. But as I was saying before, you can't analyze it. Yeah, and as I said last night, you can make a stab at what you think might be some of the reasons. But you're never sure. So let's take a box. I can say that I don't like most of Donald Judd's closed boxes, or the boxes, the open-ended boxes. And I wonder why I don't, and I say, well, I feel that he hasn't borne down hard enough on the proportions. I think that must be the reason, I'm not sure. But I can imagine seeing a box that might hit me. I can't predict what it looked like, but I can say, well, there's just a box. It might be a box. But an inspired artist will get, and I'm, see, and all the while I'm just talking in terms of, I'm stabbing. I'm making, I know it's just near hits all the time. I'm not putting my finger right on what is responsible for the quality or lack of quality. Yeah.
And the stab was like volume.
That's right, and that's a stab.
But that's analysis, isn't it?
Yeah, I say, but the, well, all right, you've got me on that. I say you can't analyze the quality. If you try to, you have got me on that, because it's quite, I'm describing the box. I'm not analyzing, really. But I say I can't analyze the quality, but I can try, make a stab at finding out what I think is responsible for the quality. But it's supposed, there is a box that I find is a great work of art, and it's supposed to, supposedly the proportion is too high and three across, and then five long. I can't be sure that that's the reason why it works, you know? Because somebody else may make another box, the same proportions, and it might not work. So I can't analyze, I can't say it's because I make a stab and say I think the proportions are felt. They're really felt.
Working on your
reaction. Yeah. Well, working on my reaction, I mean, then you go and look again. Suppose a sculpture was confined to nothing but boxes. I'm sure, you know, that there'd be better ones and less good ones, so forth. Let's see, who hasn't asked a question here?
Didn't ask one tonight.
Oh, well, this is still me.
I wondered how you felt about familiarity as affecting the aesthetic judgment of art.
Oh, I think it has a lot to do with it.
Well, can't it affect it in a negative way, too? Like,
yeah. Yes, indeed. Both things are right.
But like when you hear an advertisement and you really think it's terrible and then you hear it over and over again and then you end up singing it. And
that's a ticklish question. Oh, that's where you get infected by something?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's ticklish. I think there is some kind of aesthetic verdict there. I'm not sure what kind it is. You know, like Winston tastes good like a cigarette should, and you keep on. Maybe that has something to do with your nervous system. Yeah? And not properly to do with aesthetic take. I think in some part it has to be an aesthetic take, but I'm not sure that the reason it gets inside you is just because you like it.
Well, another thing is you were saying that you liked Norman Rockwell better.
When I was 16, yeah.
Didn't that probably have to do with the fact that you had seen more of his work?
No, I don't think so. I wasn't up to seeing anything better as better. I hadn't looked at pictures enough.
But then you said that you had, that because you looked at the great masters so much after that, then you learned to like them. But if you had looked at Norman Rockwell this much after that, would you have liked
him? No, he... that's part of what happens. Your first crushes, say, when you see other things. It isn't... Oh, well, let me start. Oh, repetition doesn't mean you're bound to like something. It means that it wears out. And to talk about the advertising jingle. If advertising jingle keeps ringing in your head, you begin to hate it. You know, the way you don't quite hate, say, a Schubert tune. Now that can, anything can wear out, but you don't find yourself hating the theme of, let's say, the trout. You know, Schubert's song about the trout. You know, it may continue to haunt you, but it won't gnaw you the way Winston Tastes Good will, or it won't abuse you either. And it doesn't mean that you keep, just by dint of familiarity you're going to like something. The first time you see, say, abstract painting you haven't seen before, if you see enough different kinds of abstract pictures, different kinds, you'll begin to make discriminations. So you won't be as puzzled as the first time. Mm-hmm. So. I mean, in my experience, that's worked out. You take people in a room full of abstract paintings and challenge them to pick the one they like most, and they'll end up picking one. They may pick you. You think the wrong one, and you bring them back in again, say, the next day, and next day. And that kind of familiarity has amazing effects, I found. I think it works the same way with certain kinds of modern music, like Schoenberg. It seems to make no sense at first.
So you're saying that in the end, the quality will...
The discriminations come through. Mm-hmm. You begin to become aware of differences that you weren't aware of at first, because everything looks like a puzzle to you at first, and then things begin to differentiate themselves. And I try it. I mean, here I'm stating something so obvious that so many people have experienced that I don't even feel I have to justify it. I have to say, you go out and find out for yourself. as with everything of real value connected with art. Sydney, you?
You've been very careful to allow for eventualities of quality, you know, at all times, and even in cases where I have reason to believe that you do not care for a certain genre in general. And it was your remarks about Judd that made me think of this. What I feel is a disparity between your modesty in the face of quality that might escape you, or in face of quality that might appear where you least expect it, and your obvious awareness that the history of quality, as far as we understand it from a consensus, shows that there's a very little quality been produced by very few artists, that the chances of being surprised are not there every day, like when you go to see a show in New York, that you have general ideas, that, you know, that Judd is infected with a certain, I believe you feel, is infected with a certain avant-gardiste.
Yeah, yes, but that
and
doesn't
this is what's been bothering me, is this constant reiteration of fallibility, as if we might be surprised by at any moment by something that would be totally new, when our knowledge and our study of history shows that quality and originality. Yes, I wanted to talk about probability last night. It comes down to that. I didn't realize I was even pointing to that. When our sense of history, our sense of quality shows that the problems of possibility and the problems of probability are not as open-ended as that. I mean, that they are almost prescribed historically.
Yeah, probability agrees with you. But I think that the safest attitude to have in the face of art is to be ready to be surprised. Not to go.
But is it
to
human nature to be constantly.
Well, I think this is where human nature has to be controlled and suppressed or restrained. Is to be ready at any moment to like something that you happen to like. Because you're not going to choose. See, that's the catch here. You go through 20 galleries in New York on a given day, and you know the probability is that most of the shows there are going to be, by and large, duds. But if you're really looking, you don't go on that assumption. Each show you walk into, you're ready to like something if it happens. And also, if you don't, and this is what I call practical seeing, you don't walk into a show of paintings and you recognize certain things all the paintings have in common, and you say, well, I know this kind of painting, and I know it's usually bad. You have to give yourself and the art a better break than that. You look at every painting one by one. Don't ever let a work of art get swallowed up in its category. And then you have to be ready, because you can't choose to like something you don't want to like. Okay? That is, admit to yourself that you like something you don't want to like. Because you'll find yourself liking works of art you don't want to like for whatever reason. And there you are, you like it. Now you've got to admit that to yourself. Most people I know in art life don't allow enough of that. They're not open enough. And I feel that this openness is necessary, not for the sake of the artist, but for your own sake as an art lover. Because you also go to art. Some of the pleasures of art are intrinsically connected with surprise. And on top of that, this, you get shaken up in an edifying way that I can't describe. Here it's beyond me. When you're forced to like something you don't want to like, it sort of shakes you. And it improves your eye, too.
There's something about the word surprise that's problematical, too.
Well, I want to go into that next week about surprise. I mean,
I don't think I'd be anticipating if I make this remark. I'm quite sure that you don't see as many shows today
as I used to.
As you used to.
You're right? Certainly right.
Well, that, there's something, I don't know exactly what I'm driving at, but there's a point in that.
That's age. Age, no. Number one.
I hardly go to shows anymore at all.
I want to keep up. I'm afraid of missing something.
Yeah, all right, fine. There are about how many hundreds of shows a week?
I miss so many.
How do you choose? On what basis do you choose?
And a very unfair basis.
Okay.
I mean, I'm only a human being. What the devil can I do? Go to spend all week seeing...
No, I was just trying to... To yeah. break
that's
perfect.
I didn't make it perfect.
Take. I mean that there are biases.
Shifting the subject here. I'm not saying that I know exactly what's what with contemporary art.
No, I didn't mean that. I was just talking about the modesty in the face of the evidence of history. The quality is
The probability. Rare. Yeah, I won't take any bet that I'll see one show next week that I like, on the whole. I wouldn't take a bet. If you wanted to offer me odds,
I would make this proposal. But you choose the shows.
Where I already
know. You make the choice every week to go, right?
Yeah, every other week.
Why not?
Now and
it
every,
would be interesting.
Every third week.
Well, it would be interesting to us if, before these seminars are out, you choose shows that you ordinarily would not see. And then come back and...
I won't have time. Friday, Saturday, and Monday the galleries are closed.
That's true.
Yeah, so...
That's true.
I won't have time.
You always try the Whitney, you're bound to be surprised there one day.
At the Whitney?
Yeah.
I've seen all the shows there until the end of this week. And...
do you think that the surprises that happen in a context of elements that can be talked about when you analyze a painting and not place a value judgment on it?
Yeah, but remember I said these, when you say analyze or describe, you're making stabs.
But see, I don't understand why, if you looked at a Norman Rockwell and compared it with a Titian, it seems that with the vocabulary that you would use to analyze and not value the Titian would be more complex in terms of formal elements than the Rockwell.
They're not. It's experience shows that you can analyze a Rockwell down to as much much schematic complexity as a Titian, and sometimes it'll seem the reverse. They'll seem to be less. Less to talk about physically in a Titian than there is in a Rockwell. That's a quantitative comparison. They don't work. And complexity is a touchy thing. You get complexity of this and complexity of that and complexity of this. And then you find yourself going around a circle. And I give you examples of art historian as eminent as Jacob Rosenberg, who wrote this preposterous book which shows how you can tell, recognize good drawings. Has anyone here seen it? And he said by its unity and by its complexity. And then you ask, well, what does complexity amount to? And what does unity amount to? You know? nothing but a series of question-begging words. You, by its integrity, you recognize a good work of art, because and it's always this big abstract word that begs for definition, which you can't define, because you can show great works of art that contradict every definition you might establish for on the basis of one great work of art. Yes, Ellie.
You constantly put down words like integrity or unity as being words that really don't help to analyze or even discuss a work.
Well, certain contexts.
Okay,
in certain
yeah.
contexts.
Well, it's sort of like how they're used. This is
yeah.
what you're complaining about. And yet, last night you said that there's something about expectation, the expectations that, in particular, good artists and particularly tuned in critics seem to share about what they anticipate or expect from a work of art, that when they confront even a good work of art, they seem to be able to tune in faster on whether it's good or bad.
Yeah,
and,
right.
That word expectation, I seem to feel that you meant something specific
no.
by expectation.
No. Again, it's something I can't define in any given case.
We're using it then.
You recognize it by the operation, so you say, well, it must. It's something like expectation. I want to talk about that next week, incidentally.
Yeah,
expectation, satisfaction. Why don't you say expectation? You expect happiness, and let's say expectations of happiness, and then definitions of happiness start rolling around like a million marbles in a closed circle.
Yeah.
You know, you expect happiness. Well, tell me what you. You know, everybody here expects happiness or hopes for it. And just try to get a definition that's satisfactory. And this isn't an aesthetic question, but I want... That's how open the word expectation is. Or how open the word hope is. Do you follow what I mean?
Yeah, well, before it seemed like you might...
You hope for something that will satisfy you, but you don't know in advance what's going to satisfy you.
Okay.
You expect something to satisfy you, and at the same time satisfy you through surprising you, say, aesthetically. But you don't know what until it comes along and does it.
Well, what you seemed to imply last night was that the people who had really looked hard enough wouldn't
have a heightened... Yeah,
well,
now I'm using another question, but a heightened sense of expectation.
Okay, a heightened sense of expectation. Would have confronted Pollock right off and not been so overwhelmed or surprised.
Well, it turned out there were only a few people.
Excuse me?
It turned out there were only a few people. There
yeah,
were a few people.
Right, okay, but there's something about the type of surprise. It's not the Philistine type of surprise, in other words, that's so...
Well, I said that. I said it's not just expectation in general or surprise in general. There's a context
but
of it.
But there's something specific about how you're using expectation and surprise. That's what I really
but
need to understand.
But I'm using it within certain limits.
Yeah,
you're asking for, wait until next week maybe, because you're asking for certainties and specifications where they don't belong.
About and, expectations?
Yeah, where they don't belong. And I'm trying to show you that expectations in life, as in art, can be open and nevertheless vividly felt, like the expectation of happiness. And we can't, and there's still there very vividly, and you might get surprised by what makes you happy. You know, usually it's another human being or other human beings, and you liable to get very surprised. Sophie, you have...
Well, can we go back to relational, like
yeah.
artist relational? Isn't it like the pleasures of syntax? That you
experience that's another word.
Realize it, you know. And then also, I want to ask another question. I was wondering if it just boils down somehow to pleasure. Like you go in a gallery and you see the paintings one week, and then the next week some other paintings are there. You walk in, like I walked in the gallery today, and I was with a friend of mine. We started arguing about a cat instead of looking at the pictures. Now there must have been some reason. Our attention wandered from the pictures because they weren't making us feel pleasure.
Well, is it the word pleasure?
It must be something that happens in your head.
Yeah, well, but this is what... We know it's there, we recognize it, we can't describe it, we can't define it. The word pleasure seems inadequate. And then we try the word exhilaration, as Dr. Langer does, and then I'd even use the word elation or excitement. And that's what I started off with last night. This is part of what's undefinable about art, that we recognize it. And mind you, things that are recognizable but undefinable, that you can't affix words to, are just as real as things we have words for and are definable. And there's nothing mystical about the non-verbalizable. It can be just as real as things we find words for, satisfactory words for. There's nothing mystical in the fact you can't put something into words. And as a matter of fact, if art could be satisfactorily put into words, a work of art, the nature of art, the creation of art, the appreciation of art, art would blow away. And that could be shown logically. It's art, one way of, art's there to deal, somehow tell you about things that discourse can. And if you want to know what discourse means, look it up in dictionary. And that's about it. And I guess that's about it for tonight, unless somebody has a burning question there. Thank you.